Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Eduardo Jordan, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Brisbane. And today on the show,
National Carers Week is an opportunity to raise community awareness among all Australians about the diversity of carers and their caring role.
This week is National Carers Week to celebrate the contributions from more than 2 million Australian carers. We found out more. Also, we found out a new online program aiming to boost GP's practices in rural communities. And later today,
he then challenged the validity of that legislation on really a whole number of different grounds, and all of those were rejected by the High Court.
We investigated why Clive Palmer lost its legal battle against the Western Australian government. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, Sydney apartment buildings are littered with defects, just over half of buildings having at least one type of defect, according to a new research released today. Buying an apartment is one of the most important purchases a person will make. But it's incredibly difficult for buyers to know or find out if the apartment they're buying is good quality or not because of a lack of transparency and accessible information. Co-author of the research and fellow at the City Futures Research Centre at the University of New South Wales, Dr. Laura Crumlin, spoke with The Wire's Michelle Stevenson about the most common kinds of defects they found.
We found all sorts of defects, but the three that are sort of particularly concerning, the most common type of defects we found were things to do with water leakage and water ingress, which basically means that the water doesn't stay out of the building or the bathrooms leak. That was the top category of defects that we came across. In our more detailed data set, that was 42% of buildings that we found had those issues. We also found issues with cracking and structural concerns and fire safety systems. And fire safety is a really worrying problem because obviously there's a real safety risk associated with not having fire systems working properly. But also people often have no idea that they've got a problem with their fire systems because it's all built into the walls of an apartment building. So you can't see it and you can't tell that there's a problem.
Why do you think these kinds of defects are so common?
Look, there's a whole lot of contributing factors. We've definitely seen a lot of deregulation of the industry and a government trying to get more buildings built more quickly and reducing the amount of oversight to enable that to happen. So there's also pressure on developers to build fast, and that means, you know, sometimes to cut corners or sort of rush things. And we've seen, you know, we're building more complex buildings, taller buildings, new technologies, all of those things can contribute to people making mistakes as well when they're not 100% sure how new things work. So there's a whole lot of factors. Training, we've definitely heard from people that there are issues with training as well. So lots of different things contributing to the situation that we're in.
What does it mean for buyers who have unknowingly bought a property with defects?
It's a really, really tough situation to be in. There's not enough support for buyers who find themselves in that situation. It's really stressful. You have to work with all your neighbours to kind of coordinate how you respond to these issues, which is not always easy. It's really technical and complex to understand what the problems are and how you need to go about fixing them. And in the system at the moment, it's not easy enough to make sure that people can go back to the developer or the builder who built it and get them to come and fix it or pay for the rectification. So one of the things we're calling for in our report is to make it easier for owners who are in that situation to make a claim and get the developer to come back or get money to get those issues fixed rather than having to pay for it themselves.
So why is this so hard for buyers to access information about the quality of these apartment buildings in the first place?
Basically because no one is storing the information in a coordinated, consistent way. So we found as researchers who were sort of focused on this task that we had to go to a whole range of different places to try and piece together the information, different parts of government, different levels of government. Some things are held just by industry organisations or companies that have done rectification work or done inspections. Strata records that the buildings themselves maintain aren't always maintained as well as they could be, or, you know, sometimes the strata owners just don't know about the problems yet, so there's no record to reflect these issues. So we really need a lot more consistency, and we need government to lead the way in terms of coordinating and collecting that information so that they've got a clear picture of what's going on and buyers can inform themselves before they make a big decision.
So your research was specific to Sydney, but do you think these issues are more widespread, and why is it such an important issue in Sydney especially?
Look, we definitely think that Sydney is not the only place with these issues. Obviously, we've seen problems with fires and cladding in Melbourne, and we've heard similar stories from apartment complexes in Queensland as well as other parts of New South Wales. We think it's a pretty widespread problem. The specifics of the regulation systems vary a bit, but the underlying issues we think are pretty widespread. So the thing with what's happened in Sydney is we've seen such a huge amount of growth in higher density development pretty much since 2000 onwards. So we have the highest number of people living in apartments in Sydney of anywhere in the country, and we've seen, you know, more apartments being built than standalone houses in New South Wales. So it's just the volume of what we've seen that definitely also contributes to how many problems we've had.
So overall, what needs to be done to solve all of these issues?
Look, one of the things we've seen in New South Wales that we think has been a great development is we now have an Office of the Building Commissioner that was introduced in 2019, and that's an organisation within government, a part of the government that is primarily focused on this issue of building quality. So they've been doing lots of work in terms of tightening up inspections of building sites. They've been tackling some of these information issues and starting to bring different data sets together. And having that body that is just laser focused on this issue is so important. One of the problems we had in the past was different bits of government had different responsibilities. Some things were planning, some things were customer service. There was sort of this fragmentation. You need that coordination within government so that you do have the one place that's getting all the information, analysing it, making the decisions about how best to tackle the problem.
In the meantime, how can buyers protect themselves when looking to invest in an apartment?
We've highlighted the fact that it's tricky, but still something that lots of us are going to do. Often it's the only thing we can afford to buy. One of the key things that we recommend is that people get a strata inspection report, which is a report you can order when you're considering a property, and make sure that that report actually looks closely at the issue of defects.
That was fellow at the City Futures Research Centre at the University of New South Wales, Dr. Laura Cromlin, speaking with The Wire's Michelle Stevenson.
A different take on Australian current affairs. This is The Wire on your community radio.
This week is National Carers Week, celebrating a small contribution of what more than 2.6 million Australian carers selflessly do for their loved ones. With the pandemic, carers faced more challenges than usual, caring more than 2.2 billion hours of care, equivalent to around $80 billion in wages. But also, there are concerns the amount of carers will increase by 2030, and support is always needed. I started asking CEO of Carers Australia, Liz Callaghan, what National Carers Week means for Australians.
National Carers Week is an opportunity to raise community awareness among all Australians about the diversity of carers and their caring role. So we want to raise that awareness across the country, and we want all of the Australian community to be aware of who carers are and what they do. And we really want the community and employers and governments to support carers and thank them and recognise them. National Carers Week is funded by the Australian Government, and Carers Australia administer it. And this is our 29th year.
Oh, fantastic. Congratulations on that one. So around 2.65 million Australians are carers. What are some of the contributions they do in their communities and the economy?
Oh, well, we did some work last year through Deloitte, and what that showed was the replacement value of all unpaid care in Australia is $77.9 billion a year, and that's an increase of almost 30% since 2015. And those figures were before COVID had taken hold in Australia. So we know that carers in Australia provide around 2.2 billion hours of unpaid care, and that primary carers spend an average of about 35 hours a week in their caring role. And these are unpaid carers doing this work. And three quarters of carers are actually working age.
You touched the trending topic of this year and last year is COVID. How has COVID impacted the carers' work over the last 20 months?
It's been quite a big impact of COVID. We know that carers are already experienced physical, emotional, social and psychological hits on their well-being. And because it's can often be a very socially isolating thing to be a carer, and COVID has really just exacerbated that. It's had an enormous impact on carers, particularly the social isolation issues. So carers have really sheltered at home with the most vulnerable Australians for almost 2 years, and they have had to balance their increased caring commitments with that because services have stopped coming into people's houses. And that might have been at the carer's request because they didn't want someone to come in with an infection or weren't sure how to deal with it, or at the service might have stopped providing a service. So that means that carers have had to pick up additional tasks and work. So they're actually really very tired. And I think that's why it's really important this week to say thanks and recognise these carers. They have done the heavy lifting for all of us during COVID.
One of the statistics that Carers Australia released is that the demand for informal carers will be estimated to increase by 23% in the next 9 years, by 2030. Why do you think the number will increase, and do you believe this is a concerning statistic?
I think it is a concerning statistic, I suppose, in one sense, but it's also not surprising. This is about, you know, population aging. I think it is also to do with the fact that carers understand that they're carers now, or starting to come to the view that you are a carer. And that's why weeks like National Carers Week are important, because there are a lot of people out there who actually have these roles. And you know, you might be looking after someone who has a chronic illness or a disability or a mental health condition or alcohol or drug issue. And of course, a frail aged person or someone with dementia or someone at the end of their life, and you might not consider yourself a carer. And so I think there's an increased recognition that you're a carer, and so that contributes to that figure. But we know that the NDIS and the aged care systems are completely unsustainable without carers. So it is concerning, and we need to make sure that we look after carers and that they're able to access support for themselves and services at local levels, and state and federal governments need to continue to support carers as well. Otherwise, it's not sustainable.
And what are some of the supports at the moment that carers have on a national level, if you can expand on that?
So the federal government rolled out last year a service called the Carer Gateway, and it is a national service, and it provides information and advice for both in-person, so face-to-face, and online. And it's available to all carers at no cost across Australia. And there's a great range of services available, including respite, which is very important to sustaining the carer role. There's also access to counselling, practical help, skills training, that type of thing. The phone number, Eduardo, for the Carers Gateway is 1-800-422-737.
That was CEO of Carers Australia, Liz Callaghan. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Eduardo Jordan in Brisbane. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on ACCC 102.1 FM, to our friends in Orange, New South Wales on Orange FM 107.5, and to the other side of the country to Radio Gulari in Broome, Western Australia. To study and become a GP in Australia is one of the most gratifying but challenging careers, particularly when practicing in a rural area. Now, a new online program is looking to boost numbers of specialist GPs in rural areas to be certified and to convince GPs to open practices day. I started asking Rural Chair of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners, Michael Clements, why there's a lack of GPs in rural areas.
Sadly, we've seen a steady decline in the number of our rural specialist GPs living and working in rural and remote communities. That's been a gradual decline over many years, and there's lots of factors. But what it means is that people living in these rural communities are finding it harder to get to see the GP. May take them longer to get in, or they may have to drive further to get their health care. And what that can lead to is poorer health outcomes, as many things might go untreated and missed.
For our audience who are unfamiliar, what are the tasks of a specialist GP?
The role of the rural GP is really to listen to the needs of the community and reflect those needs and advocate for them to our higher authorities and get health resources in. The rural GP will take people that come in with their sore knee or their mental health concern or their blood pressure and expertly manage that in a way that keeps them out of hospital and keeps them living their best life. And so our rural GPs have a very wide scope. They might be assisting with antenatal care or pregnancy care 1 minute, and then later that day they're going and doing a nursing home visit for palliative care with people dying. So we've got a wonderful breadth of role, and what we bring to the community is a sense of safety and care for everybody who needs to see their doctor.
Now, Michael, could you please tell us a little bit more about the RACGP's program to boost specialist GPs in rural Australia called PEP?
There's a number of different ways that people, doctors within Australia, can train to get this specialist ticket. And one of them, which is very flexible, is called the Practice Experience Program. And what this does is it allows people who want to train as a specialist GP to live and remain in these rural and remote areas and get a package of support from the college, where we'll be providing them resources and information and learning plans and assessment training and basically assisting them as they acquire the knowledge that's required to pass the exams. And then once they've passed our exams, they're fully qualified as a specialist who can provide holistic care to any person in Australia in any postcode in Australia. So it's a very important skill set, but a wonderful one to have.
Now, how would PEP take for a GP to do, and what's the difference with the rest of the programs available at the moment?
One of the common entry pathways into specialist GP training is through straight from university. So they might come from out of university with a medical degree. They spend 1 or 2 years in a hospital getting their internship and residency. And then they join our program and get a 2-year or 3-year training package. That's called the AGPT pathway. That's one way of joining us. And typically that's people early on in their stage of medical career. The PEP is often appealing to people who come to medicine a bit later in life, so maybe they've been a mature age person and they're coming to medicine late, or maybe they've done other things first, so they may have done tried other training areas, they might have tried out in surgery or anaesthetics, but before realising that actually the real joy, the best part of medicine is consultation-based medicine in rural towns, being a GP. And this also suits doctors who have maybe qualified overseas and are then moving to Australia to set up a new home and a new practice in those rural areas.
Now, how will a rural community benefit of having more specialist GPs in the regions?
What we know is that rural communities that don't have access to a GP can struggle because if you don't have good health care, then you're less likely to find families wanting to move there, because we all know children go through all the usual illnesses and scrapes and broken bones. We know that as you age, we know that the elderly have a high health need, with everything from managing their blood pressure, or maybe they're having falls, maybe their memory is having issues. So these key groups who are often using the most of healthcare aren't going to settle down in a town unless they've got access to expertise in that general practice care. So it's really, really important for communities to have good access to these specialist GPs, because that will draw in the families, it'll keep the elderly people there longer, and it helps the town grow and thrive.
And what about the benefits for the GP to work in a rural area?
Well, I'm a rural GP. I live in Townsville, but then I do rural and remote clinics out on places like McNeagh Island and out in Corumba and Julia Creek. What we know is, and what I've experienced, is that when we go out to these small towns, our connection to community is very strong. So we get to know all of our patients and all of the community members and the ambulance drivers and the police, the publican and the restaurant owners. We spend time with them. We get to know what the needs of the community are. We find that very rewarding because of the connection that we have to the people there. But also in terms of full scope, and what I mean by that is, as a GP, I'm trained in everything. So I can manage somebody that comes in with a broken arm or starting to have a heart attack or a child that's having a bad asthma attack.
That was Rural Chair of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners, Michael Clements. A dispute between Clive Palma and the Western Australian government, which has been going on for nearly a decade, has come to an end in a High Court ruling this week. Last year, the McGowan government passed the so-called Mineralogy Act, which sought to protect the state from having to pay damages to Mr. Palma, which would have cost taxpayers $30 billion and left WA bankrupt. Senior lecturer in law at the University of Western Australia, Morag Wesson, speaks to the Wire TAUN about these legal challenges.
There were a few reasons why the High Court ruled against Clive Palma. The West Australian Parliament introduced legislation which basically terminated the damages claim that Clive Palmer and his company were bringing. And he then challenged the validity of that legislation on really a whole number of different grounds. And all of those were rejected by the High Court. Just to run through them quickly, we, when we looked at the judgment, thought there were four key issues that were raised. The first was Clive Palmer argued, or his lawyers argued, that it wasn't open to the state parliament to amend the agreement that he had with the state regarding his mining proposal. And the High Court said actually the parliament could do that. Another key issue was that he said that this breached the separation of powers by interfering with the workings of the courts. And the High Court said, no, that's not the case. It might have changed the legal rights of Clive Palmer and his company, but it didn't interfere with the workings of the courts. He also made arguments about the rule of law, which the High Court rejected, saying that those arguments couldn't really be supported by the Australian Constitution. And as well as that, there's a more technical point that he had registered one of the arbitration awards in a different state, but that was found not to have any validity in WA, given the existence of this law that had been enacted. So it was a very clear and firm rejection by the High Court of the submissions that had been made on behalf of Clive Palmer and his company, Mineralogy.
How is the High Court's decision a victory for the Western Australian government, and how will the state move forward?
Well, I mean, it's a victory for the Western Australian government because if Clive Palmer had been successful in his damages claim, some of the reports suggested it could be as high as $30 billion, which is almost equivalent to the state's annual budget. So they've managed to spare themselves that kind of liability. I think they'll move forward in the public eye reasonably easily because Clive Palmer is not a particularly popular figure in Western Australia, so they can really say that this has been a victory over Clive Palmer, and they've saved the state a lot of money. One has to say, though, I suppose the other factor, which quite a few people have commented on, is that this does set a precedent which makes clear that the state parliament could do this with respect to other mining agreements, and investors will be aware of that. So there's potentially a question about investor confidence. What the Attorney General, John Quigley, has repeatedly said, though, is that he regards this as being a one-off case relating specifically to Clive Palmer.
What are the other implications of the ruling?
Well, I suppose the main implication is firstly that this would seem to, for the moment, at night, head off this significant damages claim, although there may be other avenues open to Clive Palmer and his company still. The political implications, though, I think are mainly favourable to the state government, at least as far as public perception is concerned. As I said, Clive Palmer is not a popular figure, so it's easy to present this as a victory over Clive Palmer. But they'll be very keen, and as they have been already, to present this as a one-off case that will not have implications for investment in mining in Western Australia generally.
That was Senior Lecturer in Law at the University of Western Australia, Murray Wesson, speaking to The Wire's Tia Ewan. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening wherever you're in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide, and Radio 4EB in Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The Wire acknowledges the traditional owners of the Turrbal land where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present, and emerging. I'm Eduardo Jordan, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Brisbane. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.
This must be the place for bookworms.
You have to remember that a worm, with very few exceptions, is not a human being.
Subscribe to 2SER for Radiothon 2021, and you can choose to go into the draw for the Bookworms prize pack. It's got a selection of new Aussie novels, vouchers for cool glasses from Dresden Vision, writing courses from Faber Writing Academy, subscription to the Saturday paper, Adventure Writer magazine, a gift voucher to Cassula Powerhouse, dinner for two at the Atomic Beer Project, and a case of Atomic Beer to boot. Subscribe and choose your prize pack now at 2SER.com.